contemporary music is changing right now. What I'm trying to do is bring another perspective into this game, to say popular music is as creative, as interesting, as inspirational as any music, you know?
We're rolling? Okay, yeah, very good. Very good. We're already rolling for quite some time. So let's see what we take and what we don't. Well, hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, for coming to watch or to listen and to another conversation. Today, I'm here with Matthias Bartholomé, a very, very cool guest, a big inspiration for me, musically speaking. And first, maybe for those who don't know who you are, can you introduce yourself?
So, thank you so much, Dominic, for having me. My name is Matthias Bartholomé, and I'm a cellist. I'm living in Vienna. I'm deeply rooted in classical music on the one hand. I come from a classical background, but for the last, I would say, 15 years, I've been doing a lot of progressive music on the cello, kind of developing my own sound, developing new ideas, influenced by rock and groove and jazz elements. I have a duo with Clemens Bittmann, Bartholomé Bittmann, which is one of the centerpieces of my activities. Yeah, and we're writing our own music, so we're really kind of diving into this idea of creating music from the instrument for the instrument, from your own instrument for your own instrument, and really trying to bring this band ideology, you know, thinking to be a band, a rock band, into the classical world.
Yeah.
And also kind of committing to a project over a longer period of time, not only kind of saying, okay, I'm doing this for 2 years and then maybe I'm changing to somewhere else, but kind of really committing and developing over a longer period of time, which
it's like a band.
Mm-hmm.
Just in your case with cello and, well, violin and...
Exactly, yeah. Clemens, so my duo colleague, is playing violin and mandola, which is a very unique instrument because he created it himself. It looks like a mandolin, I would say, but it doesn't have the double strings. It has just single strings, and it's tuned basically like a viola with an additional B string at the top. And you can play, so the range is very big.
Yeah,
so you have you have kind of really low sounds, but also very high sounds. So
at this point, I think we should, because I think since what you do is so unique, we should definitely show some of that.
Yeah.
So at this point, we'll show a little clip. So before we dive into that too much, though, I want to maybe start from the beginning. It's always interesting to see, like, how does that happen? How does it all start? You said you come from a classical background, so your family also was a musician's family.
Exactly. My father was a solo cellist of the Vienna Philharmonic, and also his father and his grandfather were musicians and also members of the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. So this is a very long story of musicians, but also connected to Viennese culture, Vienna, Viennese sound, Vienna Philharmonic sound. So I really grew up in this amazing and rich tradition, you know, of sound. And that's one part of my personality.
Yeah.
That's one part of my life. And the other part is something that developed quite early, I have to say, very heavily influenced by Apocalyptica, you know, the Finnish cello metal quartet from the 1990s. They're still playing, but in the 90s, they were starting out and kind of doing new things on the cello. Not, I would say, not contemporary music in the normal sense, but they were playing Metallica on cello. They were playing rock grooves on cello, and basically were pioneers of showing that there are more possibilities on the cello than just the classical repertoire, or even than the contemporary repertoire that was written until then, you know?
And, you know, that's I think, a huge thing, because now so many people do that kind of thing. They take a classical instrument and, oh, we do some crossover and a little bit of that because it's commercially very effective. Mm. But back then, it was not a thing.
Mm.
They were one of the pioneers who started it, who showed, no, it's not just some, you know, we do a little bit of other music on a classical instrument. Yeah. No, we really do something else on a really high level also. I mean, it's not that's something that has to be mentioned. You know, a lot of people nowadays just do it for TikTok and Instagram because they know they get views that way. But what they did or do is, is, you know, is absolutely incredible.
Yeah. As you said, they were really taking it seriously. You know, it was not just a side project or just an idea. Maybe like you're a classical cellist, but you also want to be kind of hip, you know, and try something different. And then you play some grooves on the side. No, it was really, it became something that inspired me and also many colleagues of my generation and also the generations after that to rethink the approach to a classical instrument.
Yeah.
And I think what is happening now and has been happening for the past years, and that's why I was mentioning the term contemporary music, because I really consider what I'm doing with the cello and what I'm doing with the duo and what I'm doing with my solo projects, I really consider this to be contemporary music, because it's happening now. You know, it's created now, and the difference, I would say, is that the inspirations come from popular music, come from rock music, from jazz, from elements that I grew up with and I enjoyed listening to as a kid. So that's so that the, I think that the term contemporary music is changing right now. You know, there's a certain expectation where you think, okay, contemporary music
has to be this crazy,
has to be crazy, has to be complex, has to be radical, has to break with all traditions and with rules, and has to be kind of has to be in a certain way. And I think that's part of contemporary music, definitely. And it has been part for decades already. You know, if you think what Schönberg started already developed in a big tradition of music. And there are great things happening there. And I think that what I'm trying to do is bring another perspective into this game. To say popular music is as creative, as interesting, as inspirational as any music, you know. It can be a great experience, you know,
and it can have a huge variety of expressions, of sounds, of emotions. You know, I think that is a huge difference between Europe and the US, for example, because here contemporary music is this more avant-garde stuff, very atonal, but if you look at the US, people like Andre Previn, for example, he has been doing this kind of stuff already long ago, and the kind of the borders in between what contemporary music can be and how we combine it with other things was always more of a blurry thing. I mean, started with Korngold, serious composer who then did film music, but also, you know, Williams, who not just now did another violin concerto for Anne-Sophie Mutter, but if you look back, you know, like decades ago, he already did like a cello concerto for Yo-Yo Ma and another violin concerto, I think, for Gidon Kremer, I think it was, which was contemporary, obviously, because it is happening now, but not as avant-garde, atonal as we have the contemporary scene here. But even here, I do feel, it is changing. Mm. And I think both things are valid, because we never know what the language of the future will be. Sometimes I wonder, you know, like when Mozart was alive, Mozart was not the biggest superstar. Like Van Hal was more successful, who, by the way, wrote a great bass concerto. Unfortunately, Mozart didn't. So now we're the ones who don't have the big name anymore. Yeah. But now we analyze it, right? And we say clearly, we see, okay, Mozart was just by far better as a composer, like overall. Mm-hmm. Not saying Van Hal didn't write any great pieces, he absolutely did, but when we analyze a great Mozart piece, we can now kind of objectively also, not just subjectively, say there is a certain quality there. Back then, people couldn't say that. And I often wonder, with the stuff that's happening now, what is in the future going to be the thing that will survive? And also, are people going to look back and be like, yeah, of course this is much more creative or much more well-structured or whatever it is in the end. That is always something I ask myself, because, only time will tell, but I think that's why we need a variety, because who knows what will be the thing for the future.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the most amazing thing for us living in our times now is that we have access to, I mean, it almost seems endless varieties of music, you know?
Yeah.
You have amazing specialized ensembles for Renaissance music, you know? You have, and from then to until today, basically you have great interpretations, great artists, so you can just pick and dive into this world. This is something that has never been existing before. You know, if you talk about Mozart's times, there was no way, you know, there was not, they were not kind of spending Sunday afternoon thinking, okay, what in CD collection today or on Spotify, you know, so what am I listening today? So there was only the music of the time, you know, and now we have this incredible luxury basically to choose from. And I think, so I totally agree that those different influences in our contemporary music world all have their place and all have their space. And so I really enjoy living in our times, because there are so many fantastic things going on, and constantly people defining new boundaries, kind of overstepping certain expectations and finding their sound.
So that is what I like most about what you do. But we will talk about that more in a moment. I want to first go back a bit to you and how you grew up. Because, you said a very Viennese Philharmonic focused tradition. Mm-hmm. And your education was classical, I guess.
My education was totally classical. I studied with Valentin Erben of the Alban Berg Quartet in Vienna. And I was studying with Clemens Hagen of the Hagen Quartet in Salzburg at the Mozarteum. So this is my study life, you know. Yeah. So I grew up in the classical world, also with a strong focus on chamber music, and not necessarily focusing on an orchestra career. I had this coming from my father.
A certain push? Well, we were all in Vienna Philharmonic.
I have to say, I really have to say, there was no pressure, no active pressure. Of course, there was a certain kind of expectation that it could go in that direction. And I have to also say that for a time, I considered this to be an option for my future, and I tried, and I have to say this, I mean, especially for my teaching job, this is so many valuable experiences now that the question about those auditions, you know, for orchestras. And I have to say, I kind of lived through many different varieties. Sometimes it was really close. Mm. Also with the Vienna Philharmonic, I got to the second place at one point, almost getting the position. In other times, I didn't even make it through the first round.
But it's always a luck factor.
It's a luck factor and it's a mental factor for you. And I have to say that I was struggling back then. I was also struggling with really not wanting this that much.
Yeah.
I always felt that there was something else waiting for me, you know. Mm. And what I'm talking about is this kind of creative, progressive approach to the instrument that back then was still sleeping somewhere, you know. I felt there was something.
And who knows, if you had won
exactly job
like that, then you would maybe have never done any of that.
That's very true. And so,
looking back, it might be good.
Definitely.
It probably is good that it didn't
definitely
work out.
Yeah. So I think this is also a valuable lesson for me and probably for many people out there. If you're disappointed because a certain goal was not fulfilled and you didn't reach it, it might feel horrible at the moment. It might kind of everything falls apart.
Yeah.
But it might also be the chance for something new eventually.
Or maybe
you find out
that goal was not the right goal
exactly.
for you.
There's just no way around that pain. You know,
It was for me such a similar story, mm-hmm. like so similar. Mm-hmm. You know, I did also some orchestra auditions in the past, and towards the end, I always go to the last round, like for the big principal bass positions, mm-hmm. and then it always didn't work, and was like, oh damn it! Back then, now I'm like, oh god, I'm so happy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. but then I was lucky enough. Then I won the principal bass audition for London Symphony. Mm-hmm. So, and there it's a different program than we have here with the trial. Like here, mm-hmm. we have talked about it or will talk. I don't know in which order we release things, but we have talked about that in another episode. But for those who didn't watch that, here, if you win an orchestra audition, you have a trial year. So you have a job, a fixed job for at least 1 year. In some orchestras, 2 years. Mm-hmm. And in those years, you're full time hired. So your main focus musically will be that, playing in the orchestra for that amount of time. Mm-hmm. And in London, it's different. So you get invited for a trial. Multiple people get invited for a trial. Mm-hmm. And that means first one project or two maybe. Mm-hmm. And then they see, okay, do we like the person? Does the person fit into the orchestra? And then if they do, then a few more projects. Mm-hmm. And then you get a lot of projects. And then maybe at some time here, it's where it gets difficult because sometimes mm-hmm. people are like in a trial for years and it never ends. And they're just like, damn, like
that's also unfair. Yeah.
But the approach like to try many people and try them in the orchestra, not just the only one person, that I think is fantastic.
Of course.
And then I played a lot of, so I did one project and more and then more and more. And then I just started to feel like, I felt horrible and was like, why? Like I'm playing in this awesome orchestra and it's a fantastic orchestra, mm-hmm. London Symphony. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really, that was something else. And I felt so horrible. Mm. And I was like, what is going on here? Yeah. And then at some point I realized, like, what are the things I am passionate about? And I was passionate about since I was a kid.
Mm.
It was never the goal to play in an orchestra. I like playing in orchestra now and then.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the main musical occupation I noticed now. Mm-hmm. That is, at least for now, because I had also so many ideas, so many projects, big commissions, big arrangements, things outside the purely classical world that I kind of felt like I have to do this. I want to do this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I stopped doing any projects with them. Then the trial was over and then they still asked, now I have no time anymore. Mm. Who knows, maybe now and then I will do gigs with them. But now I'm so happy because if that had worked, if one of the other auditions where I would have had like a full year or 2 year contract, all the other things I'm doing now, all the crazy arrangements, the big commissions, all of that, the whole solo chamber music stuff, it would have almost completely had to vanish because there would have been no option for it. And in your case, I'm so happy. I'm so happy none of the auditions worked for you.
No.
Because I love the stuff you do
now.
I
totally agree. I think that, and what you're saying is very interesting. And I think what what is required. You know, if you are, if you find yourself in this situation where maybe you already have this position, you know, you kind of you would have the possibility. Okay, you have this orchestra position, maybe even a solo position in an orchestra, but still you feel this urge to do something different.
Yeah,
and you have to. There is a certain kind of how do you say in English?
You can say it in German in that way.
Courage, you know. So you need a certain kind of courage in taking this risk, you know, because you don't know how it will turn out. But you need to make room for it. Yes. If you have those ideas, if you have those dreams, they need time and they need space. And you might not be able to do this out of an orchestra. So you kind of this decision to say, I'm not accepting the job at the orchestra, or I'm not doing auditions anymore, and saying I'm really focusing on my project that I have to build from nothing.
Yeah,
that takes a lot of courage, but in the end, it's the only way to make something grow. You know, to really go that distance. And so I really, to everybody who's having these ideas and wants to follow these dreams and projects. I really have a lot of respect, because I know how much courage it takes to take this risk, you know?
Yeah, because it's so uncertain.
You might end up 3 years later with nothing, you know?
Exactly.
You see, it's just not working. The concerts are not coming in. Nobody's interested in what I'm doing. Those are all those steps that you have to take to find that
you
spot.
Have to dare to take them, because you also even what you do is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Even if it is, you know, it's not sure that you will, that the market is. I will not curse yet. I think, or maybe we, no. Let's do beep. Not with the bleeping. Yeah. let's not do that yet. Some point maybe, but yeah, the market is difficult and soulless, definitely, because a lot of organizers do not care if what you do is good or not.
Yeah.
Like, they just wanted to sell in the end. If it's also good, you know, I've had these conversations with, let's just say, major people in the classical, broader classical scene, very major people. Mm. And they said stuff to me like, you know, if we look for people to work with, it is also nice if the artistic part is actually good, but mainly we want to make money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was... I would definitely not say who this is, but but if people knew what institution the person was speaking for, holy!
At least it's honest, I have to say, because
yes, though because, that is yeah
exactly because that's what it's all about, and I got the same feeling. And in the last, I've been doing the Duo Bartolomé Bittmann for more than 12 years now, and we went through so many steps. You know, we recorded 4 albums, and. We were in those situations talking to major labels, talking to big distribution companies about possibilities, and most of the time, it didn't feel right to us because after the first few minutes, everything went into, but how can we commercialize what you're doing? What you're doing is great, but. Can we combine it with this guy or this kind of thing? So we kind of put it into a package where we know we can make money off it.
Yes.
And I have to say that we always said no. We always said in the first moment where we thought it doesn't feel right to what the artistic message is for us.
It's not you anymore.
We're not going there. Even with the risk that we don't have this... a big career jump, maybe, because it's never guaranteed anyway, you know? You signed a big contract thinking next year you're going to be on every billboard. It's not like this. It's not happening like this.
If you're lucky, but if you're not even, I know a lot of stories with big labels, also big agencies, they take someone and they expect them to make the big career. And then if it doesn't happen, after 1 or 2 years, they just drop them.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah. And for me, it was also from my duo colleague, Clemens, it was one of the most beautiful experiences in our career so far. With our last album, that was, it's called 10, which is we did it as a 10-year anniversary. And we went back to no label. We just we were our own label, so there was no label contract, and we only had a small distribution contract with Preiser Records here in Vienna. So it's a very small company. And
but it is on all the streaming platforms.
It's on all the streaming platforms, but
which matters more anyways.
All right, yeah, that's true. But there's no bigger machine pushing this. You know, it's what it is. You know what you get. And with this CD, with this album, with this fourth album, we won the Preis der Deutschen Schallplattenkritik, which is a very prestigious prize.
Yes.
Which proved to me and to us that it's not in the end. It's not always about the big companies, the big contracts, the big promises. You know, it's about consistency.
Yes.
It's about you have an idea, you have something that works, you know, and you follow it and you keep going,
and it's something going. That is authentic. It's something that you actually love and that you're actually passionate about, and you can be after, well, in your case, 12 years still. You know, that's the big thing. It's not some commercial stuff that you do because it will sell. Well, no, it's the thing that you actually love, and if you love it, it might actually be something cool, right?
Yeah.
And if it's, then maybe other people will love it as well, and not just to listen to it once because interesting, okay, it was on an advertisement, so I'll look at it. No, because maybe they listen to it once and they're like, oh wow, this is something. I want to listen more. You
right,
know?
Right.
Yeah. So and that's that's where the consistency comes in. I want to ask you now, going back to your studies, classical studies, when did you start with this then? Like you said, you know, you went for the whole classical approach, even orchestra editions. At what point did you, I mean, you listened to stuff you said when you were younger, but when did you start doing yourself stuff outside of the classical realm?
Well, there are two moments in my life where something happened in this direction. And the first moment was when I was very young, obviously, when I was, I would say, 13 or 14, I started to try those. We were playing Apocalyptica songs also on the cello. I had a cello trio with Leonhard Rotschek from the Minetti Quartet, who's a very dear friend.
We played Trout together, actually, last year.
Wonderful. Yeah. And Wolfram Grün, who later became a doctor, but is also one of my closest friends. And we had a cello trio that was back in the early 2000s, and we brought it pretty far. We were writing our own music, very heavily influenced in metal and rock songs, but in the end it still felt like a side project, because also we were still studying, you know. Everybody, Leonhard already had the quartet, which was kind of, that's what I'm going to do, classical quartet. And I left Vienna to study in Salzburg. So it was something that happened, but it was not yet something I really considered like a real option for a career.
Something for fun on the side.
For fun, for this, for side. And it was not until after my studies in Salzburg at the Mozarteum, I finished, I went back to Vienna, because that was the real moment of what's happening now, you know?
Yeah.
Because if you're studying, you're busy, you know?
You're studying,
you know, so the next 3 years, 4 years maybe, that's what I'm going to do. After that, it's an open field, you know? Whatever, anything can happen. So that's
Nothing.
Or yeah. Nothing. Of
that's
course.
A big thing. That's why I think I see many universities at the fault, because you're focused to just fit in the university system. But how applicable to actual jobs is that in the future?
Yeah. That's so tricky. And I mean, I've been, it's another topic maybe also, but I've been teaching at the Mozarteum.
Oh, we will definitely go back to that later.
For the last 4 years. And this is something that I'm really concerned about. How can you bring your students this feeling of the real life that is waiting afterwards, you know? Because of course you're living in this bubble of the university, you're learning all those things, you're meeting new people, maybe you develop some kind of ensemble that might have a future later on, but it's in a way it's a bubble. It's something that you will leave in a couple of years and will drop you into the wild,
basically. Just like that, from one day to the next, and then you need to see what are you going to do. And in your case, so you went back to Vienna.
So I mean, I went after my studies. I went back to Vienna, and then I the first thing I did, I started to do auditions, because that felt the closest, and I did quite a few. Some were really close, some were a disaster. I had all those different experiences.
Me as well.
So, but on the side, I had a lot of time, you know. I was preparing for auditions, okay, but other than that, I had a couple of concerts maybe, but in general I had time. And I had a project where I met my now duo colleague Clemens, and we got along very good, and I had the feeling that he might be the one that I can get in touch with, kind of talking about a project, maybe. It was just an intuition. You know, we met and we had lunch and we were talking, and we found out that we are kind of, you know, in the same spot in our life. You know, Clemens was just finishing a project, a long-term project, looking for something new, and I was looking for my thing, basically.
Yeah.
So it was an intuition. It was really a gut feeling that this might be something worth following, and I have to say that this really developed pretty fast. We spent the first year playing some concerts really low key. I mean, we played anywhere. We in any cellar, in any club, in any gala surround, not surrounding music, but gala concert spot. We played all of it.
Yeah,
you know? Because we were just saying, okay, we want to write music, we want to write our music, and we want to play it and see how it works.
Yes, I mean, that's so important.
Yeah,
and then for me it was also when I started kind of pursuing the bass as a solo instrument. First, I did every gig, everything. Just to get some experience. Yeah. Also,
forget about the money. I mean,
at the beginning,
I understand it's easier said than done. When I say forget about the money, I mean, of course, we all need to make a living. But if you're starting out with something new, this you have to put it into a relation, you know. And I mean, if I think now where I'm now, where I've been playing 12, 15 years ago. I smile because, I mean, you know, there were concerts which were so bizarre, but each of those small concerts with no audience, with the wrong audience, with the wrong anything. Yeah. But every step brought me to where I am now.
Yes.
And those are so valuable lessons, in especially playing those concerts which feel like a disaster, where afterwards you go out and say, never doing that again. You know? At least you know that you're not doing this again.
Okay. Exactly. You know, knowing what you don't want to do or shouldn't do, it's also so important.
Learning by doing. You really have to figure it out, because also with the duo, we didn't really know where we were going. You know, how could we? You know,
like,
we were
just starting. You started with this, like, how do I describe the style you're in? Progressive rocks.
I would say theme. it's a progressive style because there are different elements. There's rock, there are metal influences, there's jazz elements, there's pop music. It's tricky to put it into the right category, because
there isn't one actually.
Not really. And that's also something that we developed, because we were saying, okay, So if there's no category yet, we build our own.
Yeah.
You know, we're making our own category. And that's what we're kind of trying to do. So that
and you eventually did it from the beginning, or did you at the beginning say, oh no, we want to do this style or that? Or did you immediately say, no, let's just go crazy. Let's just do whatever we feel.
We had one rule, and that was, it's going to be acoustic. Okay. It's going to be, I mean, we play amplified live, but there's no electronic effects. There's no loop pedals. There's no distortion.
All the sounds come from
everything is acoustic. That was the one rule. And the other rule was we're writing our own music. We're not doing arrangements. We're not going into playing covers, you know? That was something that we... Because we said those are kind of... You can maybe go this way or you go this way. And we felt like we really want to find our own repertoire.
Yeah.
And that left kind of no space for arrangements.
Yeah.
In the following years, we did a couple of arrangements, which were fun, but it's not the core of the duo, which I really enjoy because it keeps a certain kind of purity to it. I love arrangements. I love writing arrangements. I love playing arrangements, but for the duo, it's not the
main focus, right?
The main focus, yeah.
But who do you do the compositions like together, or one writes this piece, the other one writes that piece, and then you make it fit, or how does it work?
It's everything is composed together in jam sessions. There's never been a piece where one came with the piece basically ready and just said to the other, okay, can you play this? And that's also, I mean, that's a very delicate process because you can do it when it's just two of you, you know?
Yeah.
You might be able to do it if you have the right personality balance.
Yeah.
Because it's a delicate thing.
Yeah,
it's
really, I can imagine. Yeah. Especially for so many years.
Yeah.
And you know, how often fixed constellations get into fights.
We have been discussing many things and getting into kind of arguments about details, of course.
Yeah.
But in the end, it's something that we enjoy and that brought us also to this point. And what developed over the last years was that in certain pieces, one of us takes the lead, you know, kind of takes the lead and the other kind of follows.
In the creating process?
In the creating process. Oh. You can never really say, and we don't know it beforehand. I don't know how it's going to turn out before.
But if you feel like, oh, for this, I have many ideas. I think this is...
Exactly, and then, yeah. Then and you, then, you take then the... I play it for Clemens and when he says, yeah, okay, then... And already you have this dynamic.
Yeah.
And in another situation, I remember very well in the last composition process, Clemens, we had a lunch break. Clemens, we were coming back. Clemens took the mandola, immediately started doing some tapping things, extremely cool. And I was like, okay. And now I follow, you know? And then it's chaos. Basically, it's chaos because it's because you just follow the energy and if you feel like okay, now we're getting stuck, or the egos go like this, you know, like I want to go there, and okay, then you have to figure it out.
Yeah,
but it's a great process, and I think also I'm learning a lot as a human being in this kind of constellations because you have to kind of balance your own will against other ideas, and so that's a beautiful thing.
That's the same in any more intense relationship, you know, with a partner that you're together with, or just with chamber music partners that you play more often. I learned and still learn so much also within teaching, you know, and to know, okay, when can I say what I want to say, when I do bring that in, and when do I, am I more on the reactive part?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I mean, in chamber music, that's the most exciting part, actually, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we played now about half a year ago, the Trout Quintet. Mm-hmm. I was very sick back then, like really, really sick.
You did a great job.
I didn't notice so much. But I remember, like, to me, it was so fun because we have never played it before together.
Yeah, true.
And I've played the piece so many times, right?
Yeah,
so for me, when I played with somebody new, who I actually appreciate as a musician, because if it's somebody, you know, if it's somebody not so great, then the gig better be paid well. Otherwise, I don't want to do it. But if I play with somebody who is has a great musical mind, then it becomes really fun, because then I can see, oh, this thing is new. Oh, maybe I can adapt it. And maybe afterwards I won't do it anymore. But maybe for the moment, it's like, great new inspiration.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh wow, nice, awesome.
Yeah.
But so for you, in your case, so you started this out like shortly after you were done studying.
Basically, yeah. The year afterward, I met Clemens, and then we really went for this developing this duo idea. And I remember doing maybe one or two auditions more, but it already kind of crossed.
It was clear. You're not
because it's gotten more and more clear that I want to go into this direction. Also, after finishing in my studies in Salzburg, I started playing at the Concertus Musicus, the mm-hmm. orchestra from Nicolas Hanekur, who passed away in 2016. But so I'm talking about playing old music on gut strings. So I became solo cellist in this ensemble, which basically was an orchestra. Is an orchestra,
but not in such a
stiff way, and also not in a. It's a project orchestra, you know. Yeah. You play projects.
You don't have like a fixed contract. Yeah, this amount of projects you have to do.
Exactly. So this was also something where I said, okay, that's great because there's a lot of flexibility and the music incredible. Is great, and I'm working with Nicolas Hanekur, which had already been a big inspiration for me, and those. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2016, so I only had 5 years of really working closely with him.
But 5 years you played in that
five
orchestra.
Years. I mean, wow. I'm still playing,
yeah,
but not as much because the calendar
is too full.
More full, and also my certain priorities shifted a little bit in other directions. I started the professorship at the Mozarteum, so. Things are changing.
You know? Yeah, yeah. But that is incredible. I didn't know you.
Back then I was playing a lot. And
yeah, because for old mm-hmm. music, that is one of the best, especially with Hanekur, exactly. was one of the best ensembles for that kind of music.
Definitely.
I mean, that must have been fantastic.
That was fantastic. And
how much did you play? Like how much would you play back then? Now, of course, less, but back then.
I mean, back then there were about four concerts in the cycle in the Musikverein in Vienna, but then there was Graz Festival in the summer, and then maybe there was an opera also. So it was quite a lot.
Mm.
And that's something that was incredible, inspirational, and I took so much. Also, I have to say, I took so much for the duo developing because this spirit that Nicolas Hanekur was living in his way of making music. Had a lot to do with what we were trying to do. Really, kind of going, you know, Hanekur has one quote that is kind of almost like a mantra, which is I'm trying in English, but true beauty only exists at the edge to disaster. You really you want to go to the edge, where at any moment. Everything can fall apart. Your strings kind of rip, the instrument explodes, the intonation goes off, the sound. That's where you want to go. You know, you want to find this ultimate dedication also to the music and to the sound and to the melody, and not just spend your time in some kind of safe space where you say, yeah, okay, we play solo, then everything is in tune and everything is nice, but you don't feel anything, you know.
But I think then it comes back to authenticity in that because he kind of really symbolized it. Wasn't he principal cello in Vienna Symphony, right?
Exactly.
And I've heard this story. I don't know if that's a true story, but I heard the story that back then, like the deciding factor for him was when they played. You probably know the story, but it might be interesting for those who listen. Yeah. When they played Mozart 40 in the orchestra, and everyone, you know, that's a tourist melody. Everyone knows it, like from the advertisements about Vienna, and actually, it's a tragic first movement, very very dramatic.
Mm.
And then they played it with some conductor, and the conductor started already smiling and went like, you know, in a groovy way, and which totally did not represent the music, but
exactly.
which represents a tourism concert basically. Yeah. And he was got so fed up with playing like that he said, no, I'm gonna become a conductor myself. I'm gonna bring the truth the truth as I see it out of this music, and not just some little tourism thing that people expect. And because his soul as a musician, to his authentic way of music making, the cheap tourism version would not fit.
Mm.
And that's the thing that I see. Maybe that's what also you noticed by going into this duo, because I feel often it's in the end about finding what is you. Where can you say something that is authentic, but also in a way maybe unique? Mm. I will tell a little backstory here, because back in the COVID times, I was practicing a lot of cello, more than bass even. Mm-hmm. And before and after and during, I played also chamber music more and more with the cello. And I like the cello. I love it so much. And at that point, that was the area when I was still, like, before I just started with the orchestra auditions, and I was so fed up with this whole scene, you have to play like that, you have to be like that, that I thought, you know what, maybe I'll just go to the cello. But what kept me on the bass was the idea that if I do my crazy arrangements or big commissions and stuff, I can really do something unique and maybe change the scene of the future, or at least gravely influence it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, on the cello, so many things have been done. What can I do that's new? And that's where I'm so impressed with what you do, because, cello has been, let's say, as an individualistic instrument, so not just part of an ensemble, it has been much more in the focus than the bass. Mm-hmm. So on the bass, there are many more things you can do that have not been done before. But on the cello, so much has been done. Yeah. And still, you manage to, with the duo, but also also with solo projects, you have managed to find your own unique language, not just in interpretations, but also in your pieces. Okay, the duo you started creating quite immediately after you were done with the studies. But when did you also start doing solo or other stuff that you composed?
Well, I would say in 2017, I started to write the first solo pieces or also ensemble pieces. Because people were approaching me, asking me if I could write something. And I said, well, never did it, but why not?
Yeah.
Let's try. And I already had my experience working in the duo, so I thought, let's just go for it. And so I started to write ensemble pieces. I have two quartets for cello ensemble, and until now, this kind of solo approach developed in something that is happening right now. Actually, I'm about to release a new album.
Very nice.
A solo album.
When?
Which in May.
Also, so it might be already available when we
might be available.
Let's see.
It's May 2024.
Yeah.
It's gonna be released, and the what story solo.
Just
yeah. And the idea behind this solo album kind of goes back a few years, because I was. This idea of developing a solo program always kind of was a part of my thinking, and I didn't really find my voice. You know, I said, okay, I could do all Bach suites.
Yeah.
Okay, has been done before. I could do it, but it's not something that I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
Or I could do, I don't know, Kodai Solo Sonata, amazing piece. There are so many amazing pieces for solo.
Yeah, but many people have done those.
Have done, and have done it perfectly and great and everything fine. Okay, I still could do it and be happy, but still, there was no spark, you know, there was no something that I really wanted to do. So, now, I'm playing a cello by David Teckler from 1727. It's my father gave it to me 10 years ago
after
he retired. And it has a very beautiful lion scroll, so it's a really beautiful instrument. It sounds amazing. I'm really blessed with this. And 4 years ago, in the summer of 2020, a German violin maker, Philipp Bonhoeffer, who's living in Italy, he approached me and he said he's specializing in copying old beautiful instruments. Mm. And he would be interested in copying this, in making a new copy of this David Teckler Lionhead cello. And I said, okay, let's do it. Let's meet. And I went to his place in Tuscany, beautiful village in the like really Italy, Tuscany picture postcard.
Nice.
Village. So we spent a lot of time there, and we're talking about music and instruments, and he has a very unique way of creating his instruments, because he's doing a scan, a 3D scan of the instruments, like really precise. You can it takes 5 hours to do the scan in a huge machine.
Yeah.
And then you have this 3D model where you can go inside the instrument and move around, and you have all those irregularities, all the imperfections of the instrument.
Yeah, yeah.
And based on this 3D model, he builds the instruments. So it's not only the measurements, but it's also, he tries to go even one step closer in recreating irregularities and all imperfections, things, so that he gets as close as possible.
Wow.
So 1 year later, he finished this instrument, and I played it, and I was like, it's an amazing instrument. It sounds great. It sounds different than the original. It's
I mean, it's newer wood in the
end. It's new, and it also looks a little bit different, has a different varnish. So it's its own entity. It's its own character.
Yeah.
But also the lion head is very beautifully done. So suddenly I had those two instruments. You know,
yeah.
One 1727, the one 2021. And that was the moment where I thought, okay, there is my solo program. I love Bach. Bach is, it has been, the solo suites have been with me for since the beginning, basically. But I also recently started to write solo music for cello. So I had basically the two representations of my Bach and my music.
Yeah.
So the solo program that I've just recorded is played on two cellos. So I'm playing on the old cello and on the new cello. And I'm playing on the album, I'm playing the third suite by Bach.
Mm-hmm.
So that's six movements. And in between that are seven pieces of my own.
Ah, between kind every of, movement. Yeah, so it's one Bach.
It's not not necessarily. Sometimes it's two Bach and then two. It's
however it fits.
Yeah. I tried to create a story that goes out of its prelude, Allemande, Courante, Sarabande.
Yeah, yeah.
I tried to break that up. You know?
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Because
we've heard it a million times.
You know? Yeah. So so the order is a little bit different sometimes. But in general, that's the idea, and for that I'm still waiting for how it really works on the CD, because it's a visual project, you know, it's a visual program.
Isn't there a recording online where you do it in Radio Kulturhaus?
There's a live video, and so I'm playing on the two cellos. The one position is here, and the other is here.
Yeah,
and I usually play a piece by Bach and then my piece on the one cello, which is kind of going into each other, the pieces.
But you change cello also in the concert.
Then I'm leaving this place and I'm talking a little bit about the idea, telling the people. Also, that's a very important part of the program, the talking, because I have to introduce the people to what I'm doing, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Why is this guy coming out with two cellos, you know?
Yes.
There has to be a reason. So that's...
They didn't have enough money for two cellos. No, but I think the talking is so important.
Super important.
I do that in every recital. Because not only to explain a specific concept like you do, but even if you have a normal program, just to give the audience a chance to get another way of connecting to what is happening.
Yeah.
And they love it. They always appreciate it. And I appreciate it when somebody great comes along and then has something to say that then makes me connect to what is happening even more.
Exactly.
It makes the whole life experience better. Otherwise, I can listen to a CD also, you know.
Exactly, yeah. And that's something that's changing. And I'm really happy that you're also incorporating this into your recital programs, because it breaks this barrier between the audience and the artist on stage.
Yes.
Because there's a certain kind of
the audience.
So no, you kind of you said it very beautifully. You get a different kind of communication that way.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you don't have to talk about deep historical information about the pieces.
No, no,
you can do it if you want, if you know it. but
even then, not too much. Right. Some people might love it and some would be like...
Hey. Yeah, yeah, right. So if there's really something... I'm just saying this because maybe this is some kind of expectation for young musicians to think like, yeah, but what am I going to say? You
know? Yeah.
No, you just say hello.
You feel like,
you know, it's a say hello and I'm happy to be here. Enjoy. That would be enough also.
Absolutely. Already, yeah, so. That would already break the ice. Right. Or, you know, what I often do is if there's maybe a personal story with mm-hmm. a piece or a reason why I love a piece.
Oh, yeah.
Then or any little side fact that I find fascinating about
exactly.
a piece
yeah.
that might be interesting to mention. Yeah. I mean, it should be something that a person themselves thinks is interesting.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And in your case, so you you start with Bach and you end with Bach, or
so
how does it work in your
solo
program?
So, I start with a little intro piece with just pizzicato, arpeggios, and then I start with the prelude, and then there's some talking, and then I go to the other cello, and then in the live program, I have to say it's always Bach and my music, always interchanging, because it just makes sense, because I'm moving to one instrument and then I want to play Bach and my music on that cello and then I move back, and also in terms of time, that makes sense, because it's almost usually it's like 10 minutes music and then it's talking and then it's 10 minutes music. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So this is a very fun solo project. It's a little bit tricky because I have to travel with two cellos all the time now, but it's worth it. And
you know, I once traveled with a bass and a cello.
Yeah,
like I used to do it. Now I don't anymore. That's why I don't play so much cello anymore. But I've once had one day with three gigs. So the first gig was bass and orchestra,
mm-hmm.
and then in the afternoon twice the same program with first trios with violin, cello, piano, and then violin, bass, piano. And so I was traveling before for the rehearsal and everything with cello and bass. And
oh my God. I mean, yeah.
But two cellos is already, I mean.
Two cellos. I mean, I'm not.
One you carry, one you, like on the back and one you carry in the hand.
The problem is that I can only do this project in a vicinity of Vienna where I can go with a car.
Yeah.
Or maybe train. But I cannot fly with two cellos. It's not possible. I just found out last year. Yeah, because I was booking a flight to Hamburg.
Not booked, just two seats or something? No?
That's what I thought. Okay, so I'm having my seats and I have two extra seats. No, it's only you can only
get
one extra seat.
Aha.
So for that trip back in May where I played my solo program in Denmark, I asked my father to come with me to carry my cello.
No.
So because I needed somebody to sit in the plane and have the cello next to him. In the end, it was fantastic because I brought my mother too, and we had this trip to Denmark, and we were visiting the Larsen String Company, which I'm very lucky to be part of this Larsen family.
You work with them?
I'm working with them very closely, and they are producing, in my opinion, the best cello strings.
So I work really with Tomastic, so of course I have to say they have the best cello. As a Viennese person, especially you.
Yeah, so,
no, but I like the Larsen strings on the cello a lot. They don't make bass strings, so.
Ah, really? Yeah.
No, that's only for the for the good instruments.
Yeah.
Bass is more as a percussion instrument.
Yeah.
You know,
so. Right. No, I heard that Tomastic makes the best bass strings. Yeah.
Well, of course. I mean, 100%. They absolutely do.
Right.
But I like them, actually. Yeah. If I found others that I liked more, I would play those.
Mm. Yeah.
But for cello, I also tried the Larsen on many different instruments. I think in the end, whatever cello you have, whatever sound, there it comes again back to what is the sound you want.
True.
And I think, but Larsen has a huge variety of strings. That is also, I think, quite nice.
They also have been specializing on the cello for a very long time.
Yeah.
So they have kind of a many years of experience already. I'm super happy.
You know, I recently heard the story how that whole thing started from Franz Helmersson, maybe you know, big cello pedagogue. And he told me once he had a gig I think it was Denmark, and he played a solo concerto with an orchestra, and in the orchestra, one of the orchestra musicians afterwards said, hey, you know, can you come over to my place later? I want to show you. I'm starting to develop my own strings in his garage. Mm-hmm. So he went there to some machines in the garage, and Franz told me that. And then, yeah, that was Larsen. That was the start.
Lauritz Larsen, yeah. He started everything from his garage, kind of had a vision, and built something really beautiful. Yeah.
And by now, with the stuff you're doing, so, I mean, besides the duo, but your own compositions, your projects, in the cello scene, it gets very well received, I think. You know, in Cello Biennale in Amsterdam, for example, they always play many of your pieces, and also with the bigger cello ensembles. Mm. And when did you see, okay, the stuff that you're doing, not just as a duo, but overall what you do as a... as the person that you are, as a not just purely classical cellist, but also as a composer, as a creative mind, when did you see that is really taking off, that there's an audience for that?
I have to say, that's such a fluent process. I'm very lucky that many great things have happened in the last years, and you were mentioning the Cello Biennale, which for me is one of the most amazing festivals worldwide, especially concerning the cello and all its varieties. There's another Cello Biennale this year in October. I will be there. I'm writing a commission piece for solo cello for the competition of the Biennale.
Ah, very
and
nice.
We will be playing with the duo, and I will be playing also classical, but also my pieces. So the beautiful thing is that the Cello Biennale gives you the opportunity to experience so many great approaches to the cello on a very high level. So this is really a melting pot of many things. Yeah. So I have to say, this was a big push in feeling that what I'm doing and what we are doing also with the duo is something that people appreciate.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, before we were talking about thinking commercially, and the dangers of kind of saying I don't want you meet some labels and they say but we want to make money. In the end, that's not a big issue, because you are yourself. You're always also in the question: is that what I'm doing on stage received by an audience? Is the audience appreciating it?
Yeah.
It's not a one-way street, you know. I'm even though I'm really following my intuition on the instrument and I have incredible freedom, I still, part of what I'm doing, what I'm writing, also incorporates: will that work for an audience? Will that be an interesting story? You know, of course, you cannot please everybody.
Yes.
And if that takes over, if you only think about, okay, what makes everybody happy?
That's impossible. Also,
That's impossible. And then the quality of your music will suffer.
Yeah.
But it's a balance, you know?
Yeah.
You take your own ideas, you take your own dreams and your own music, and then you see how it works, you know? And then... And
it is about communication, and you're trying to tell them a story, trying to tell them something. And if nobody understands it, then it's also, the concerts are a good for me, they're like the bullshit filter, kind of.
Right.
Not only for repertoire and musical ideas, but also for technical ideas.
Yeah.
That's why I think for somebody who teaches, it's so important to play concerts, because so many things that if you explain them with words make a lot of sense, but in reality, they're just not working.
That's very true. That's very good.
And the same with pieces. And in the end, I mean, but I think often the stuff that's, in my experience, in the long run, the stuff that gets received the best is the stuff that's the most authentic. That's the most what fits to the person themselves.
Yeah, definitely. No, definitely. I think most people have a feeling for what's real, you know.
Yes.
And if you're really authentic on stage.
Especially nowadays. Yeah.
People notice and people feel that and give it back to you. What I'm looking for in my music and in my programs is something that I regard as something I enjoy, and I feel like many people are enjoying it also. Contrasts. You know?
Yeah.
You go to a concert and you want to to experience a story, you know. You want to experience a dramatic story, you know, which is which goes through the motions, which goes through the emotions, which leads you to the brink, maybe like Hanoku said, to the brink of disaster, also in a musical term, where kind of everything is distorted and breaks apart, followed by some kind of salvation, you know, some kind of. So those things are.
I mean, just imagine a movie where everything was just going along easily.
Exactly.
Nobody would want to watch that.
So that's kind of, if I'm doing a solo project with only nice melodies, that's not going to be very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. For 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
Maybe. Yeah, could be. But it's always the relation of stories and elements.
Yes, yes.
If we think about our interview here, you know, the sun keeps coming in and out. Yes. No, it's really it's a play of shadow and light.
Yes.
And if you incorporate this into the music, that's what excites me, and I feel like most of the audiences look for that. You know, they want to go in and leave with something changed inside. You know, they lived through something. Maybe they lived through some childhood experiences or some emotional journey that
otherwise they would have not been able to experience. I mean, that isn't that beauty, and that's why we make music.
That's why we make music. That's why we make live music, because that's the thing. We all have all those technical things that make our lives so easy can never replace this live moment. You know, this commitment for 90 minutes or more or less, where you're just at this place, you're experiencing it in that moment.
And everyone at the same place, at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the crazy thing. That's what brings everyone together. And that's what I love about life. And that's what is sometimes so easy to lose, because you need to play correct, you need to play perfect.
Yeah.
You know, that what we often get taught in the classical school. And that is, for me, always, it used to be such a huge thing. And then at some point you realize, doesn't matter if it's perfect. It doesn't even matter if it's correct. Nobody cares. It needs to be an experience, and that's what people want in a concert. Maybe not in an orchestra edition, but definitely in a live concert. Yeah. And I think it's so incredible that you're doing what you're doing. And I'm a huge fan. I will say that
likewise,
already. I listen to a lot of your stuff, and I will continue to listen to a lot of your stuff. And thank you so much for taking the time for this.
Sure. Maybe because you were saying what the last thing you were saying is so important about this this idea of mistakes.
Yeah.
And since I've been teaching at the Mozarteum for 4 years now, and the something that I learned, you know, because teaching, and that's also one of the big things that I learned in the last 4 years, is a lot about learning, you know.
Yes.
Because it's not a one-way street, you know.
100%,
I learned so much about cello playing in the last 4 years only by working with those young talented cellists, and I see that in this part of their lives, you know, they're just starting out with a bachelor's study or maybe master, maybe a little bit more advanced, but still there are so many questions in their life about where do we go, and how will the future be, and this fear of making mistakes, and this fear of this idea of I have to be in a certain perfection level and only then I can make music.
Yes.
This can be very overwhelming, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've been there too. Exactly. I've been there too. And when I was studying, it just weighs you down, and sometimes you cannot help it, because still you're in this university, you have all those different cellists who are playing the same pieces, and you start, but he's playing it better, she's playing better, I cannot play anything, you know. So you're constantly in this judging mentality,
and you think about what somebody else thinks about your playing while you play, and that's the end. That's the end of it.
I mean, I have to say, with experience and with the time that I spent now since my studies, this feeling of what are the people thinking about my playing, it doesn't really go away.
No, not completely.
Know? But I deal with it in a different way.
Yes,
you know?
Yes,
and that's interesting, because the one of the big differences between my cello playing now and my cello playing 15 years ago is that not necessarily that the thoughts changed or the feelings changed, but the way that I deal with them, that changed, you know?
Yeah.
I found more security in accepting also the possibility of failure, you know, accepting the possibility of playing a wrong note and this kind of stuff. This is...
I think it's a lot about repertoire at some point. Like for me, it's a lot about... Okay, I know my strengths and I do know my weaknesses. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I will better choose pieces that really fit to my strengths.
Right. Right.
And then there may be certain pieces that I won't play.
Yeah.
And or at least, you know, not right now.
Yeah.
And then, or at least not at the beginning of a concert and so on. And so it's kind of...
Of course, yeah.
Because nobody is perfect. But I think sometimes those limitations, everyone has a limitation. Mm. Everyone has a few weaknesses. Mm. But sometimes having those... And realizing you have those, but makes you then realize, but then I do have some things that I am really good at. Mm-hmm. And then that makes you do incredible creative things. Like,
exactly.
I often wonder, like the great instrumentalist composers that we have, like, you know, Rachmaninoff, Liszt, Chopin, or Kreisler on the violin, and so on. How many of those just did their own stuff because... they were just inspired and it was great. And how many of those did it out of necessity in a way because other things they couldn't do so well. Mm-hmm. But if they wrote their own stuff, there they would be free and incredible.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a big issue. That's a big, a very true issue. And that's also something, I mean, we could talk very long about this, but but just let me say this. That's why I also think it can be an important aspect for anybody who's playing an instrument. Okay, we're talking about string instruments, we're talking about the cello, to incorporate into your practice routine, into your life as a student, playing music without sheet music, you know?
Yeah.
So going into, I would say it has to do with improvisation, but not in this kind of, okay, now I have to be the big jazz improvisator. No, it's about just playing without sheet music. You have your instrument... What is keeping you from just playing a melody, you know, and enjoying that melody and finding the connection here with your fingers?
Yes.
That can be, and starting to believe that you can do beautiful things and you're not required to play some repertoire.
You know,
it's art is very fantastic, Beethoven sonatas, fantastic. But you're also a human being with ideas and emotions. And creativity, find that. Because I totally agree with what you're saying, that if you find this voice, and those composers like Kreisler, for instance, who wrote his own music, he also did it out of necessity because that's where he was the best. You know, he knew that he could be mostly himself. And this is something that you can start to develop.
Yeah.
You know, you start small. You start with a melody. On the next day, you play two melodies. And then maybe you play a rhythm. And you slowly start to develop a freedom in your musicianship that is not dependent on classical repertoire.
Yes.
And when you come back...
Or classical rules.
Or classical rules. And when you come back to the classical repertoire after that, you know...
Suddenly you're free.
You will feel a little bit lighter. You will think about this opening... of Beethoven A major sonata, maybe a little bit more free, you know, because
absolutely
it's just a melody. Okay, it's a genius melody. It's by Beethoven and it's fantastic. But where's the difference, really?
Yeah.
You know, it's all music. And
absolutely.
And sometimes we get overwhelmed by this repertoire and so many recordings, you know, and I already feel the weight on my shoulders.
Yeah.
I already feel it.
Same point. You know, because I think a big thing is emotion is motion in the end. There is no healthy motion. And in the end, everything we do is motion. Every bow stroke, every shift, it's all motion. We're moving around. Mm-hmm. And none of that works well without emotion.
Yeah.
Like if I look at great cellists, violinists, whatever, even before they play the note, they have a certain movement. Mm-hmm. Every movement, everything is connected to a certain gesture, a certain expression, a certain emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And often through this correct way of playing, through of the rules that are set, we tend to lose that and lose the emotion in it, and through losing the emotion, the motion which is in the end the technique also, becomes really bad.
Oh, yeah.
And that's something I had to also learn. And, and I realized it also a lot with music outside of the classical, when I played more Piazzolla stuff or more like with Georg Breinschild, more jazzy stuff, I noticed. Yeah. Because there it's not about playing correct, it's about being in the groove. And then all of a sudden every movement becomes part of the music. And then you notice, hey, actually, I can have this kind of freedom, this kind of emotional connection, or I should have that in a Beethoven sonata as well.
Exactly.
And then the Beethoven sonata becomes awesome.
So, yeah, that's it.
Awesome.
Well said.
Well, I think that's a good spot to end it. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.